Mr. Reinhart, we appreciate your acceptance of the appointment in this case. It was a little bit of difficulty finding somebody who would be an effective advocate of the defendant in this case, and we thank you for taking that role. Our next case, number 5 this morning, is Wolverine Mutual Insurance against Vance. Mr. Agostino.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. The simple issue that we bring before the court on appeal here is that Judge Miller did not correctly and completely apply Indiana law, and he should have. This was a case, insurance coverage case, brought in the Northern District of Indiana as a diversity case. And under the Erie Doctrine, Judge Miller was required to follow substantive Indiana law in determining the issue there. The issue here is we have a person who shoots my client, Johnny Vance. Mr. Gingery, the shooter, was convicted of attempted murder in the Elkhart Circuit Court. We filed a personal injury claim against Mr. Gingery. Wolverine is his liability insurance carrier. Wolverine filed a declaratory judgment action saying we don't have a duty to defend Mr. Gingery because of the intended or expected injury exclusion in our policy. And under Indiana law, the expected or intended exclusion is viewed as somewhat ambiguous in terms of how it gets interpreted relative to the insured. Question there being whether we have a subjective viewpoint or an objective analysis of that issue. And the Indiana courts have looked at that and interpret that in favor of the insured, in this case Mr. Gingery, the shooter, to look at subjective. Did he expect the injury to occur? And if we follow this analysis, what this leads to is something that is recognized as problematic in Indiana. And that is that you can have two different results. You can have a conviction in a criminal case against a defendant, but in a subsequent civil case where intent is an issue, that very same defendant may be found to not have acted with intent. And in that situation, going forward here in our case, if we prove in the civil case in Elkhart Circuit Court that Mr. Gingery did not have the mental capacity to commit a crime, or that the shooting was accidental, he was armed, he did not exercise due care in defending himself, but falling short of intending to injure or expecting my client to be injured, in those situations when we obtain a judgment, we can go and collect from the insurance company. And
how? What is the step that would give your clients greater rights than Gingery himself has? Right, the insurance contract is a contract between Wolverine and Gingery. And we already know that Gingery has no right to defense or indemnity under that contract, not simply because of the criminal prosecution, but because he defaulted in this case and has not appealed. So there's a final and non-appeal judgment of the district court in this case that Gingery has no rights under that contract. How could your client have rights under a contract that's already been conclusively adjudicated in this very case not to apply to this tort?
I think if you present the question that way, it unfairly boxes us in this sense.
Just reflects the fact that Indiana is different from Wisconsin. Wisconsin's a direct action state, and Indiana is not. And therefore, your client's rights are derivative from Gingery's. In Wisconsin, they'd be direct. Now, it really sounds to me like you're trying to make Indiana into a direct action state, and that's pretty hard.
Well, not in this case, but in some future case, perhaps. But if you look at the contract, the insurance policy here that Mr. Gendry does have, it does not talk about an exclusion that applies to criminal or intentional.
No, but I'm not asking you about the contract. I'm asking you about the consequences of this litigation. Gendry is a party to this suit. He defaulted. He's not tried to appeal. And therefore, it has been conclusively adjudicated in this suit that Wolverine is not obliged to defend or indemnify Gendry. That's the basis of my question. How could your clients have any rights when it's been conclusively determined that the contract does not require Wolverine to defend or indemnify Ginger?
I think that I would have to point to a finger of looking at, is this otherwise fair in the circumstances of the case? And under the circumstances of the case, Mr. Gendry, who may or may not be mentally incompetent, we think he is not competent, did not put forth a defense which has consequences on my clients who have not yet had an opportunity to litigate this. And that basic unfairness has to count.
Mentally incompetent, you could have applied for the appointment of a guardian to defend his interests and therefore yours derivatively. Because presumably what in the end your client would like to do is win the underlying lawsuit against Gendry and then take an assignment of his rights against the insurer.
Correct.
The problem is that at this stage he has no rights against the insurer, and therefore your assignment is worthless.
Well, I think that kind of gets to the issue here, though, is what point should that be determined? And I think that that's been prematurely determined without having all the evidence.
But it's already been determined, and Gendry is not appealed.
Well, it should not be determined, and should not have been determined, because we didn't have an opportunity to present that evidence.
Even if this was a direct action state like Wisconsin, the insurer could use as collateral estoppel, offensive collateral estoppel, the conviction of an intentional criminal act, which is excluded under the policy, couldn't it? The result would be the same.
Well, not necessarily, because while they can use the offensive collateral estoppel tactic, that is not conclusive under Indiana law. So that they can present evidence of the conviction to support their claim that there should not be any coverage under the policy. But there can be also be other evidence introduced. And because the conviction is admissible but not conclusive, we should have our day in court under Indiana law. And that's what we're asking for here. But give us a chance to present this evidence. Let's see where the conviction comes out. Let's see if we can prove our underlying claim, and then let's determine where the coverage lies. And we simply haven't had a chance to do that in the way that this case has worked. And if you look at the Meridian, the Petty case, and Kimberlin versus DeLong, the two Indiana cases that address this issue, they clearly allow for inconsistent results. And that's where I think Judge Miller made an error in law. He didn't follow those opinions. He's basically saying, well, we're not stopping you, the Johnny Vance, the victim, from making this argument, but too bad you're not going to have any coverage. And what Meridian and Kimberlin say, no, that's not true. He may end up having coverage if we prove that he's liable for an offense that falls within the coverage. And that hasn't occurred yet. So the question is, how can you adjudicate that there is no coverage when those events that would trigger coverage have not yet occurred?
How does Gendry, either vicariously or somebody, who makes the request? Is it a guardian? Who makes the request for Gendry, if he's not going to do it, to the insurance company to defend and all that? They obviously initiated this themselves to get a declaratory judgment.
And they have obtained counsel to defend him in the underlying action. I suppose, as Judge Easterbrook has pointed out, we could have petitioned the court to appoint a guardianship. We haven't done that.
No, you say in the underlying case, his insurance company is defending him?
They have assigned defense counsel, yes.
What does that mean? When they assign defense counsel, that means he's employed and defending?
Yes. All right. Reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ballard.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Dave Ballard, and with me today is Mr. Jim Groves on behalf of Wolverine Mutual Insurance Company. Essentially, I have only one point to make, and as your honors have pointed out, Indiana is not a direct action state, so that an injured party has no rights against the tortfeasor's insurance company before there is a judgment against the insured. So in this case, as the lower court stated, Wolverine Mutual's contractual obligation runs only to Mr. Gingery. So the victims in this case are free to get a judgment against Mr. Gingery, and if they do, that is when they have rights, either through an assignment from Mr. Gingery of his claim against the insurance company for indemnification, or they may proceed in a proceeding supplemental, which is a derivative claim. In either way, all of the Indiana law is clear that the victims in that case would stand in the legal shoes of the insured, and they could have no greater claim than Gingery himself can have. Now, one of the points that the appellants made in their brief is they took a comment from Justice Givens' concurrence in the Kimberlin case as an endorsement that he points out that if you allow this to happen, you can have inconsistent results in different cases where you'd have a criminal case where if it's an intent crime that you would have a conviction, but then in a civil case you have different results. What they don't add is that Justice Givens then adds after that, a judicial policy that does that is not a very attractive policy.
Let me ask you where this whole thing goes. If if Gingery in state court would have been convicted of not an intentional crime, but some sort of negligent, reckless use of
a reckless manslaughter.
Yeah, something like that. Would you be stopped from relitigating that issue?
Well, neither side would be stopped from anything because since he's not convicted of an intent crime, he's convicted of something of a lesser standard. We could not use collateral estoppel then to
could
define coverage.
They use
cover
it against you and say,
no, because
been decided this, that he was only guilty of a negligent offense.
Well, but I don't know. It, depending on what the crime is, that would not necessarily mean that he didn't have a higher standard of culpability. He just met the culpability of whatever was charged, unless he was also charged with an intent crime and acquitted of that. If he's just charged with a lesser...
Well, let's say that would be the situation. It's a typical lesser-included offense, as we had in the last case, that you could, the judge could, or the jury could decide that the person didn't act with intent and committed some lesser-included offense.
Then I think in that instance...
Are you stuck with that?
Well, that would be kind of the situation where Gingery or the defendant, the criminal defendant, would be trying to use that against a party who was not a party to the case. And while we don't have that issue here, and it probably doesn't matter to the issues we have in this case, but probably not, because then the insurance company wasn't a party to that case. It wouldn't be held against them. It's, you can only use collateral estoppel against a party who has litigated a particular issue and effectively lost it. But one of the problems with what's trying to happen here isn't just the potential for inconsistent verdicts in different cases. You could have inconsistent results in the same case. Because in this case, because Gingery was convicted of an intent crime, there is already the declaration that Gingery himself does not have coverage. But to allow then the appellant to do what they wish to do and say, well, but we still want to prove that he was negligent, you would get an inconsistent determination in the same case that Michael Gingery does have coverage. So you'd have two declarations in the same case that are not compatible. And in that instance, the victims would still be left with the same problem of how are they going to collect any sort of judgment once they get a verdict. They still have to do that through Gingery. And if Gingery has no rights, they cannot proceed through them. And the only other final point that I would bring up in case it comes up in rebuttal, there was a suggestion in the appellant's reply brief that one of the cases that we cited Hawkins versus auto owners has since been overruled by the Supreme Court. I don't think it has. I mean, there's one, that was a 1993 case, and in 1994 the Supreme Court decided Kimberlin, where they receded from an implied holding that two dissents said was unnecessary. This reference in the 1995 case of Crawford versus Delaware Superior Court, they referenced this in saying overruled under the other grounds, but no case has ever done that. And even in the Zepeda case, which is 2000, they reference Hawkins and don't call it as being overruled. So I would suggest it's either a printing error or just a mistake.
What about the state case that the other side said that counsel was assigned or something? I don't understand it. That represent Gingery?
I think...
What is that? Is there a pending state case? There is, isn't there?
There was the personal injury case,
yeah,
which
whatever.
Was stayed.
Yeah, yeah,
but
stayed.
Right.
It's pending whatever goes on here.
But Gingery has counsel, and he had counsel in this case. He just didn't appeal the result. So unless the panel has other questions, I will finish my time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Agostino?
The importance of the case here today is that if we do get a judgment in state court and come back here, but later on seeking coverage, Wolverine's going to say, wait a second, it's already been determined there's no coverage, and we haven't had a chance to prove a claim that falls within coverage. That's why Judge Miller's decision should be overruled. It's premature. It doesn't have a basis in the facts in terms of what claim is actually being presented. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And the case is taken under advisement.